From Whispers from Eternity, number 61. In the summer days of life, teach me to gather honey from the flowers of all spiritual qualities that blossom in the garden of truthful souls. I will store the perfume of forgiveness in the honeycomb of my heart, the lotus fragrance of humility, myrrh-scented devotion, the rare honey of all soul qualities. And even though the snowflakes of wintry experiences and earthly separations whirl about me, I shall seek thee in the honeycomb of my heart, where often I have found thee stealing the stored honey of my devotion. Wherever thou hast come, in every place hallowed by thy feet, I will lie, touching thy footprints. Ah, there alone will I find a place of true safety. Swamiji once mentioned to us a sermon that he heard given by the minister at the church his mother attended, a Protestant church, probably a few miles from here, actually, because his parents lived in this neighborhood. And the minister was talking about how heroic the saints were because they loved everybody. And now I don't know what part of this Swami was extrapolating from the minister's premise and what part of it he said. But the way Swami would talk about it is that the minister talked about the saint's capacity to love as if not only did they love the crabby neighbor who lived on the right side of them, but they also loved the curmudgeon who lived across the street. And then after they'd recovered from that tremendous effort, they were nice to the nasty old spinster who lived on the other side, you know, and just go on and on, like one by one, by a tremendous act of willpower, the saint could master his inherent aversion and be kind like that. And of course, for many people, that would be a great accomplishment, just not to be at war with everyone around you and not to be constantly judging everyone around you. But it's a classic example of what Patanjali called missing the point, which is you sort of get a little piece of it, but you take it off in a direction because the fundamental premise is unknown. So in the Bible, Jesus tries to make it more clear to us, you know, that you have served me. And then he lists all these things that none of his devotees did. But he claims, Jesus claims, that you were serving me in doing all of those, because whatever you do for the least among you, you are doing for me. So Jesus is telling us lots of things about himself in that story, which is, if we think even of the circumstances of his ministry, many of his followers were hoping for worldly power. Not necessarily even for themselves, but at least for Jesus, so that the oppression of the people would cease and they could have a position in the world and all these things that they wanted. Perceiving the tremendous power of Jesus, many of his followers translated that into the only terms that they could think of, which was worldly. So their idea of Jesus was not that he was the least among them, but that he was the greatest among them. He had miraculous powers. He manifested wisdom. He loved them in ways they'd never been loved before. All of this was there, which caused them to think more and more about the magnitude of his consciousness. So to be told that when you're serving the beggar and the imprisoned and the sorrowful and the distressed, you're actually serving him, it wasn't an easy teaching to understand. It's important to realize that, because once we sort of have have it all neatly codified into the Bible, and we know what it's supposed to be, and then we have Swamiji explaining it to us, and then I come after Swamiji, and then you come after me, and everybody's telling everybody what all of this means. We don't want to really fall into Patanjali's trap and miss the point. Because the point is, what's being asked of us is a total revolution of consciousness. And that everything that we normally think of as right and good and natural and appropriate and just fine is just fine, because it isn't. It's Swamiji put it in the path when he was talking about Master. He talked about how charming Master was and what a wonderful, loving friend he was and what a joy it was to be in his company. Just all these things that you could say, as all the disciples of Jesus said about him. And Swamiji said, too often, disciples reveling in the bliss of the Master's company, and these are close to Swami's exact words, failed to perceive the magnitude of the revolution of consciousness to which he was calling us. It's just everything. Because the way we see the world is not the way the world is. The way the Masters look at the world, it's a very different place to them. We see all these different gradations of acceptability and lovability and dharma and kindness, the absence or the presence of it, and our hearts are naturally drawn to that which vibrates with us. It's just the way we are. We have an affinity. You know, we meet people that we have an affinity with, and that's the way it is. And we find it easier to see God and to love God in those that are more like us. But the revolution of consciousness is to realize that God is equally present everywhere. And even more powerfully, everyone is equally loved by God. And God cheers the villain who is, you know, a tiny bit less villainous for his progress, just as God cheers the saint who realizes God. The difference is not in God's love for us. It's in our ability to receive that love. Now, the greatest misery of existence is when we close our hearts to that divine presence. And as we become more sensitive on the spiritual path, we become more sensitive to that anguish. And we begin to see how great is the tragedy for those who can't feel that divine presence at all. And as a consequence, behave horribly in this world. They imagine they can get power in this way. They imagine they can get pleasure in that way. They inflate their egos and then use that egoic power, you know, for self-aggrandizement. You don't have to look very far to see it. We're living in early Dwapara, and it's not a very inspiring time. It's just the way it is. I remember I was with Devarshi, and I believe I was either with him or I heard about this later. I no longer recall. Driving by some movie theater, and there was the big marquee, and it had the movie advertised. I don't know, you know, the classic awful movie title is The Texas Chainsaw Massacre. So I don't know whether it was The Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Think about that. You know, as a movie title, is it actually a movie title or is it just a joke? I don't even know. But whatever it is, Devarshi saw, you know, some marquee with a name like that and remarked to his companion, who might even have been me for all I remember, and said, imagine a planet where they make movies with titles like that. And imagine, we're living on it. It's like, really, how did we get here? Well, it must have seemed like a good idea at the time. And it is a good idea, because it's immensely challenging to our ability to see the presence of God seeking its home in bliss wherever we look. Because that's the revolution that's being asked of us. Not that we master our aversion, but that we abandon all aversion. Because everywhere we look, what we see is the power and the presence of God seeking to express itself. And however, the more profoundly misguided, and when we see people in tragic, oppressive circumstances, the law of karma demands that we have to believe it's not a mistake. This is why a lot of people don't like the law of karma, because not only is it challenging when we look at others, but it's also super challenging when we look at ourselves. And we have to overcome the idea of punishment and come to the idea that things are unfolding in the only possible way to bring us back to that state of bliss. Because the greatest anguish in the world is to be unable to receive God's love. And so we have to continue down that road of anguish until it becomes worse in the way we think about it. The anguish of our separation is worse than the effort required to come closer to the Spirit. And of course, if you're on the spiritual path, this is a conscious awareness, but it's the same for everyone. There's a divine force pushing everyone through millions of incarnations, I must admit, and through many, many odd and dark byways. But eventually, what we have to understand is that everyone is just the same. Everyone longs for bliss, and everyone is equally deserving of our compassion and our care because of it. But this is heroic, not heroic in the way that minister was thinking about it, but heroic because of the absolute necessary energy to constantly redefine our own sense of self and our own expectations of this world. So much is written about expectations, you know, and attachments and so on. Every word of it is true. And we just keep moving step by step. And everything that we try to hold back, God eventually pries it out of our hands. Now, all of this sounds like really, really bad news until we have the opportunity to see the fruits of this effort. Now, we are living right at the beginning of Christmas, you know, the time when the baby Jesus is born. And the baby Jesus was born. There was a physical Jesus, there was a Mary, there was a Joseph. All of this beautiful story, which has been refined and elevated and celebrated, you know, until it's a piece of music. The story itself is just a piece of music. And in its harmony and its melodies and its aspiration. And so touching that just the mere sight of the elements of that story, which, you know, we have some on the altar, we're celebrating Mary and the angel Gabriel, and Gabriel coming to Mary and telling her that, you know, that she was going to be the mother of this holy child. And then in the next few days, as the holy child comes. But it would just be history. It would still be a lovely story, but it would just be history if that was all there is to it. But what we see in Christ and in Mary and in the whole unfolding, extraordinary, dramatic story of his life, which comes afterwards, what we see is the fulfillment of our own destiny. And we celebrate the birth of the baby. It's a symbol too obvious, which is that we're affirming and celebrating the birth of the first stirrings of that Christ consciousness within us. And it's announced by the angel, and it's presented to us by our Divine Mother. You know, the symbols are so easy to float into. And then comes Jesus, who confounded everybody's expectations by not being a worldly king, by not cultivating the powerful class, by not seeking anything for himself, by associating with low caste people and fallen souls and the poor and the meek and refusing to pay attention to where worldly power was, and loving with the purity, with complete self-surrender and without effort. I have a difficult time enjoying almost any cinematic rendition I've ever seen of Jesus's life. Some are better than others. Because my favorite humors, it might have even been just when Jesus was turning water into wine, what to speak of raising Lazarus from the tomb. Because he looked like he'd just run a marathon. He was just sweating and exhausted from the effort to turn the water into wine. You know, just pushing and pulling and trying to do it, and the effort it took to love the poor and all of that. It's just, again, completely missing the point. When we see the world as it really is, and the only way we can see the world as it is when we feel the reality of it within our own selves, then we don't have to try. It's, we can't not love. We can't not feel bliss. Swamiji often told us at the end of his life of an experience he had. It had a whole context. He was in Florence, Italy. He woke up in the middle of the night, and I can't remember at the moment. Did it come from a superconscious dream, or a vision, or just a realization he had? And then he wanted to write down the perception that he'd had, and he couldn't find any paper in the entire hotel room, and he found a little doily that somebody else had already used as a notepad, and he turned it over and wrote on the back, you know, and we still have the doily. But he wrote on the back of it, everyone is seeking bliss, and therefore everyone is just the same and equally lovable, because when you understand yourself and therefore everyone at their heart of hearts, we realize that we're all exactly the same. We're all, well, truly lost and wandering and grabbing at straws and soap bubbles, hoping to find something there that's never going to be found there. I mean, the most powerful tyrant in the world is just lost and lonely, grabbing at soap bubbles. He has the karma and the egoic strength to exercise his delusion with tremendous power. But alone in his heart, he's exactly the same as everyone else, lost and lonely, until we find our home in God. St. Augustine said, "The heart is restless until it finds its rest in thee." Sympathy for ourselves, understanding of ourselves, a touch of the divine coming in and showing us what real love is, where real bliss is, changes our perspective on everything. Unfortunately, it doesn't always change it instantaneously. It's a battle that has to be fought again and again and again and again. But we want to fight it in the right way. What we want to understand is, you are everywhere. That's what the Bhagavad Gita says. He who sees me everywhere, who seeks me everywhere, he is dear to me, and I stand close to him. Isn't that what we want? It's such a simple instruction. See me everywhere. In a beautiful film about Mother Teresa of Calcutta, she was on the streets of the city, and there was some poor dying person who was, you know, had no place to be and was just literally dying on the street of some terribly disfiguring illness, and just everything about the person was there would be a natural instinct to be revolted by it and not go close to it just because of the physical disintegration. Mother Teresa goes right up, puts her arms around him, and moves him into her house of the dying. And, you know, the reporters are following her doing this. And she says to them, "You must wonder how I can do this." Because Mother Teresa was a very straightforward, she was not at all pretentious person. I had the opportunity to meet her briefly several times. She was one of the most businesslike people I've ever met in a certain sense. There was just no space in her life for any pretense. "You may wonder how I can do this because you see, you know, a maggot-infested, dying beggar." She says, "I see the face of Christ." That's just as simple as that. "You think I'm picking up a dying beggar. I'm picking up Jesus. I'm carrying Jesus into his home." And that was not pretense. That was not affirmation. That was just how she sees the world. This is what's being asked of us. Whether we serve the poor or whether we live alone in a cave, it's the revolution of consciousness that's being asked of us. This constant experience of God within and the perception of God everywhere. That's what the Bhagavad Gita tells us. And the result of that, is quite predictable. We will be with God everywhere. That's what will happen. It's not really mysterious. It's just not easy. Because so much of our belief in where our happiness comes from has to do with the likes and dislikes of the heart and the expectations that others will fulfill our desires of them, and then the crushing disappointment when they don't, over and over and over again. So we just keep trying to arrange our lives so it won't happen again, because few of us really comprehend the magnitude of the revolution that God was asking us, calling us to. So that's why Jesus came and lived a life so contrary to what others expected and to what most people want. To those who, if Jesus says, if someone slaps you on the right cheek, then turn to him the left also. If someone asks of you your cloak, give him your coat as well. Whether one does that literally or not, what he's actually saying is the likes and dislikes of the heart must be overcome. Because no matter what this world looks like, it's all just a play of light and shadow. It's all just a play of light and shadow. And in the end, vanish the veils of light and shade, lifted every vapor of sorrow, sailed away all dawns of fleeting joys, gone the dim sensory mirage of love, hate, life, death, health, disease. Just all of it. It just goes away. I mean, when we drive down the street, it appears to be there. But in our heart of hearts, it must be just always one perception, one reality. God alone, Om Guru, Om Guru, Om Guru. God alone, God alone. This is what Jesus is calling us to. This is what Christmas is asking of us. This is a peculiar Christmas. It's going to be different. But it has within it the potential to be far deeper. Because so much of what we prefer is being taken away from us. Do we desperately reach for it and try to hold on? Or when someone asks of us our cloak, do we give him our coat also? Inwardly, at least. This is the question. Right now it's just the baby Jesus, but we know the great King is also coming. And in that form, the whole of the Jesus is there. Open our hearts, open our minds, open our spirits. In a prayer for love and for courage. And the birth of Christ will be more than a beautiful symbol. It will be the actual new beginning of our own spiritual revolution and our freedom in God. God bless you.
The song we are going to present for you right now is an old German carol from the early 1600s that was later arranged by Bach.